Okay, folks, what we're going to do is we're going to kick off. We are expecting another speaker, so we'll probably just mix our order around a little bit, if that's okay. So I'm EJ Scott. I'm the curator of the Museum of Transology, and I am your chair for the third trans session. Welcome to taking part and playing your part, your role in today's gender revolution. I would like to introduce this session. It's called Trans and Intersex Autobiographies as Archives. And it's an interesting mix of speakers. Each speaker has 20 minutes, then we will, at the end, if you'd like to keep your questions, keep notes to yourselves, and then at the end, we'll do an open forum for questions to the speakers directly, okay? So, our first speaker this morning is Esther Suananon. And Esther's currently a master's student in Women, Gender and Sexuality Studies at Thammasat University in Thailand. And she was very humble in her autobiography when she sent it back to me. She had edited out the fact that she was the first Thai scholar to have disseminated a queer archive to Thai academia. So, you know, whoa. Thanks, Esther. I'm not keeping that to myself. She's currently researching Katoe history through the analysis of personal, formal, informal archives and applied queer archival theory. Esther's interest in Katoe and trans issues crosses a variety of disciplinary fields: history, art and media, political science, anthropology and ethnography. I would like you all to welcome Esther. Her paper's called They Should Be Seen and Heard, Retrieving Memory of a Trans Child Through Rereading My Elementary School Notebooks. Welcome, Esther. So we're welcoming Marie-Louise Holm. Marie researches in the areas of intersectional feminist studies, the history of medicine and technology, and bioethics. So that's short for BRAINIAC, yeah? They've published articles on trans and intersex history, feminist and queer theory, as well as a book with Morten Hilgard Bulow on notions of masculinity in the history of sex hormone research in Denmark. In 2017, they finished a PhD project, Tima Yenis, at Linköping University on the 20th century experiential and medical accounts of intersex and trans persons. They're currently a part-time lecturer at the Science and Sund facilities at the University of Copenhagen. Today, their paper is titled Lived Lives, Livable Lives, Reconfiguring Queer Approaches and Analytical Strategies in Reading and Rearticulating Intersex and Trans Autobiographies of the Past. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to add also that, as you can see on the slide, I've been so incredibly lucky. I still don't understand how it happened, but I have been employed from August as a senior lecturer in a permanent position at the University.
Yay! So, congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. So that's where you can find me in the future.
Okay, great.
Yeah. What I'm going to talk about is based on my PhD thesis, which I defended in June 2017. I'm going to give you a link to it at the end. So if you're interested in looking more into it. Just to say very shortly, and my presentation will be largely actually on ethical issues in relation to reading trans and intersex autobiographies, but I'm just going to outline very shortly what's the kind of material that I have analyzed in this in relation to this. So I have collected a lot of around 54 cases of trans and intersex persons' autobiographies from around 1900 to the beginning of the 1970s from the Danish National Archive, and they contain it. So it's cases, it's application cases for the Danish Ministry of Justice for change of name, which implied in that period also change of legal gender status. Applications to wear the clothes of the so-called opposite gender or sex, which it was illegal for persons who were categorized as men or male persons to wear what was defined as a female dress of different kinds in a certain period. So you actually had to apply to the state for permission to do that. Mm. And then also applications for castration or oophorectomy. They cover, in this context, they cover that it you had to apply for having your goals removed if you wanted to have genital reconstruction surgery. So the content of the case files I found was, it was autobiography, so they were written by people themselves, and some of them were on request of medical experts, but quite a lot of them were actually written by people first, and not with any specific purpose, but then handed in to the medical experts. And as you probably more or less all know, these autobiographies have been a substantial part of the evaluation in such cases for psychiatrists, medical experts of different kinds, legal advisors and so on, to assess if they would let anyone have medical-legal transitions. I've also found a lot of different kinds of letters between applicants and medical experts, but also letters from, for example, family members, partners, lovers, colleagues, and medical certificates, of course, also connected to the cases, very extensive physical and psychiatric assessments, and then also notes from meetings in the medical legal council and the Ministry of Justice, where you can see how the process of decision was made in different ways. Okay, so the question I want to discuss here is how can you use queer theories and methodologies to read and rearticulate trans and intersex autobiographies in ways that recognize people's lived experiences and precarious conditions? So there have been quite a lot of conflicts actually between queer researchers and trans and intersex researchers since the 1990s. This is what I want to discuss, like what's the basis of that, and also to suggest a methodology for how you can do things differently to avoid some of these conflicts. So, but you can say, okay, when we're talking about what kinds of precarious conditions are people in or and have been in, you can say for both trans and intersex people, fundamental questioning and denial of people's experiences of their gendered self, sex, body, and sexuality, different kinds of stigmatization and discrimination, social exclusion, verbal and physical violence, in the uttermost case murder as well. And all this, of course, has and does result in high rates of mental and physical problems, poverty, homelessness, suicide attempts for quite a lot of people. There are also, of course, people who are in very good conditions and so on, but I mean, I think that most have also experienced continuously different kinds of questioning or problems or threats. Mm-hmm. And you can say these problems are found for all LGBT QIA plus people in different ways, but they're especially high rates, most pronounced for transgender and intersex persons. Mm-hmm. Specifically for trans people, historically, but also in many contexts now worldwide, people have to go through long and detailed psychiatric assessments, which are prerequisite for getting access to medical transitions. In Denmark, this was given up in 2018, but you can see, like, when you talk with people, it's actually still going on with some of the psychiatrists and so on. And also, castration or oophorectomy have been a prerequisite for getting access to legal transitions in Denmark until 2014, and it's still also in many other countries. For intersex people, there have been these routine, so-called normalizing genital surgeries on infants and children who are underage until 2019 in Denmark, and it's still also going on. I mean, there's a lot of debate internationally about giving that up. There's a lot of resistance specifically in Denmark. on that, I would say. So the law says now you are not allowed to do that, but it's still going on. Yeah. So as I said, since the 1990s, there has been quite a lot of queer scholars have been applying an approach when they're analyzing autobiographical accounts of trans and intersex people who have that have aimed to assess in different ways if people had in some way like subverted or were confirming conventional notions of gender and sex. And this has really been problematized by different trans and intersex scholars, so I'm going to go through some of these. You can say this is not a specific kind of reflection on this, but Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick wrote about this, about you can make paranoid readings or reparative readings. So pointing out that it has been really a common practice in much of the postmodern queer research to use paranoid readings, which are defined as very suspicious readings that aim to, in different ways, trace, decipher, and expose origins of discrimination and false consciousness in different ways that cover up these kinds of workings. Yeah. And then you can say, okay, what have been the effects in different ways that have been pointed out by trans and intersex scholars of having paranoid not readings of the autobiographies? Tobias Raun and Henry Rubin, they didn't write together, but these are some of the points they made about that, is that trans and intersex people's life stories have been analyzed from this paranoid perspective in a way that they call dissecting, with the purpose of exposing heteronormative structures. And you can say this has resulted in two things, both in kind of instrumentalizing of people's life stories to make theoretical points about how gender is socially constructed, but also to ignoring what are actually trans and intersex people's lived experiences and what can we learn from those in different ways. Also, as queer scholars, I should also say I'm a queer scholar myself as well as a trans person. So it has been really central for me also to look into this in different ways, these kinds of problematics. So it's not like I'm extremely against queer theory or anything. I think it's extremely productive. But I think we really have to work through this in different ways, these problems. So Raun and Rubin have also talked about that. This assessing of autobiographies as either being subversive or reproducing gender norms in different ways. But on the other hand, if they have looked at intersex people, so this was for trans people, they very often have actually ignored that most intersex people identify in binary ways, not all. But going from some kind of assumption that if you have a queer body, that is a body that is considered to be non-normative in relation to what is read as a female or male body, then you must also logically have some kind of queer identity, and this is actually not the case. And you can say there's some kind of underlying expectation that trans and intersex persons have some kind of specific responsibility for deconstructing gender stereotypes because you have experiences of having your gender challenged, for example, and so on. You can say that if you have a binary gender identity, a lot of the critiques have been that you are not critical enough or you are reproducing stereotypes, and this is harming especially women and queer people, and it's like a reproduction of a harmful gender ideology. And then you can say, okay, what are the problems with this form of argumentation also when we have this background of what are the conditions that people are living under? You can say by only focusing on trans and intersex people in deconstructive analysis and not taking in, I mean, very rarely looking at people who are positioned as cis in different ways and non-intersex persons, people's identities, trans and intersex people's identities, are in some ways presented as more constructed and destabilized in various ways. So you can say that it actually contributes to this questioning and undermining people's gender positions that that a lot of people are fighting for their whole lives or every day or in various ways, and that are always experienced as more in danger of being destabilized and questioned than other people's, and denied also quite often. Other effects is you can say that, you can say of course also that then cis people's, non-intersex people's gender identities are more supported and stabilized and so on, so they're not taken up. And you could claim that actually also when you're thinking about all these psychiatric assessments and so on, the scrutinizing of people's gender identity, since that, most queer analysis don't have this, of course it's like a side effect of that you're having another kind of project that you are going after, that you want to look into this, like how gender is constructed. But at the same time, it actually, it comes to do this, some of the same things that the psychiatric assessments do, and just dissect people's lives in different ways. So I think in that way, you can say it feeds into that kind of violence that is done to people. And it's definitely, most queer theorists really don't aim to do this, but that's the effect it has, you can say also. And so Sandy Stone is one of the, there are many people, but Sandy Stone, for example, has just in the 1990s also pointed out that it's really important that that you take into account what is the context of people, what are the cis and heteronormative pressures that people are subjected to all the time. And of course, both within psychiatry but also in public, people are constructing and telling their stories, narrating different things so they fit, so you can be recognized, so you can be intelligible, and also so, of course, you can get access to medical legal transitions that some people really need in order to survive. Then to talk about how to do this differently in different ways. I think that you can claim that many of the queer analytical strategies, they have actually not been designed, they have been designed for making analysis on a structural level, so not on the individual level. And I think that's a fundamental thing that's important to look into. And I would suggest that it might be more productive to use other reading strategies when you're focusing on the autobiographies. And Judith Butler has also actually worked with this in different ways, because her work has also been, she was one of the first, of course, to also point to and say intersex and trans people's gender performances and life stories are really interesting because they make it very clear that it's not a natural thing, your gender or your sex and so on, it's something that's constructed. So we can see very clearly here. But at the same time, she's also, and she's saying then also like that there are many ways that you can see these kind of gender performances that don't live up to the norm, that they might be subversive in different ways and push these norms and change them in various ways. At the same time, she also points out that it's very difficult. You can't just decide, in most situations, if something is subversive or normative, it can very often have both kind of effects at the same time. So you have to look very carefully at the context and the situation and for whom is this, for whom does it change anything, and for whom is it challenging, and for who is rejecting it, or who is just like seeing it as repeating gender stereotypes. So Butler has suggested that maybe it's better to move the focus away in when you look at trans and intersex people's life stories and conditions from this assessment, to instead focusing on how different trans and intersex people have tried to create more livable lives for themselves. What are those strategies in different ways? And she also argues that it's actually a basically like it has always been a central queer strategy to do this in order to also, you know, you can work together in solidarity in different ways for improving the conditions for LGBTQIA plus persons. Yeah, so Sedgwick is also talking about that there's a need for, so paranoid readings are valid. They can be very constructive in many ways and also necessary, but they should actually be supplemented. It shouldn't be the only way of analyzing. So another way of reading can be affirmative readings, where you, in some ways, when you do a paranoid reading, you very often, you expect to find discrimination, heteronormativity, cisnormativity, and so on. But if you do an affirmative reading, it can be, in some ways, a more open reading, where you're looking and being like, okay, I might be surprised. Maybe I find something that is not that. Maybe I find something different, something that is constructive, actually. And that affirmative readings is a way to engage, hopefully, as a researcher, when you are looking at the past and look at and also imagining, okay, things might have happened differently then, but it could also be happening differently in the future. Sandy Stone is one person who has really inspired me in many ways in how to read differently. So she also in the post-transsexual manifesto actually makes it like a two-part analysis, I would say. So there's both this like on the structural level, actually a very queer deconstructive analysis of this medical life story of the true transsexual. But when she looks at the individual life stories, she pays much more attention to, she doesn't try to deconstruct, but more says like, okay, how have people actually used different strategies for obtaining state and social recognition? What are the practices that were silenced in different ways? So to pay attention to that. So on the basis of that, the way I have been doing it in my analysis of autobiographies is that I have done the same put the same focus on looking at these strategies that the trans and intersex persons have used in order to try to obtain permission. And also for making their lives more livable, so you can trace these things, but also to look, there are also a lot of cracks, there are also a lot of different stories actually popping up in the material of different kinds that counter these normative stories. And I don't try to assess if people meant, I mean, what is like a construction that you just tell, do you believe in it or not? I mean, it's impossible to tell that. Mm. Nobody can do that. But I think what you can do is to trace out all these layers, all these different narratives that are playing into each other. And then I'm also looking at these kinds of ambivalent processes that people are both, like, they have to be incorporated into these medical legal systems and their discourses. But in many ways, they're also othered and pushed out in different ways. So I don't assess this about, like, is it normative or subversive, but I more look at what are the effects of these different kinds of strategies, and for whom and in which context. So you can also see a lot in the archival material that, for example, for one trans person or intersex person, it might be really effective. So they get this, they get this access to medical legal transition. But at the same time, it might also kind of solidify practices within that system that closes the doors for another person, or the other way around. Somebody is rejected, they are living their lives in some kind of way that is considered to be extremely transgressive, and the state wants to close it down. And then that can also actually close the doors for other persons or open it for others. So the last thing I would say is that I have, you can say I've been asking some other kinds of questions in it. So the new questions I have been going from is that you can say, what do protagonist successes and failures in obtaining permissions tell us about the norms, available categories, and regulatory structures of medical legal systems and other social contexts? And then also how individual strategies have affected the situation for the persons who use them and the shaping of medical legal systems, and thereby the possibilities and limitations for the individuals after them. Yeah, so my focus has been on the firstly on which are the individual strategies for creating more livable lives, then the level of what's the this kind of collective violence, the state regulation, but also the enabling of transitions and the responsibility I put never on the individual level, but more on the collective level, you can say. And I've been looking at what, when do you have overlaps, when does it differ, the interests of applicants and medical legal experts in different ways. Yeah, so it's some of the people I've been writing on, and you're not going to get anything of the autobiographical histories and so on, but they are in the thesis. yeah, so you can read that and see if you think that I in some ways kind of succeeded or failed or something in between in applying this this approach in different ways. But my focus is very much on this, like, how did people live their lives? How were their lives actually, to a large extent, very livable, even when they were undermined or like rejected as unlivable by medical experts?
Great, thanks. You have to give credit to a queer theorist that comes to a queer conference and then calls queer theory paranoid, don't you? I was really struck by the... It makes me think about my own practice, and I'm really struck by the progressive ideas surrounding trans autonomy and trans strategies, and giving it the credit that it deserves and the space. Excellent. Thanks a lot. Did we find your Jerome? Right.
Well, he's not here.
Oh, he didn't come? Okay. Must be stuck somewhere. Okay. We were going to have Jerome, who in their biography made it clear that they were a white, trans, bi, working class, non-disabled writer and spoken word performer from France living in Berlin. He's published 3 works of fiction in French and German, and his first play was staged at Maxim Gorky Theatre here in Berlin in 2015. Credit where credit's due, he translated Kate Bornstein's Hello Cruel World. So, you know, I imagine that if Jerome was here, they'd probably be really cool. his autofictional memoir was published by Hansa Berlin in 2019, so really recent work. He teaches creative writing at Alice Solomon University of Applied Sciences and is doing PhD research at Berlin University of the Arts, where he's examining empowerment through performance poetry in queer spaces. It just feels fair, if he's been delayed, for us to give him credit for the effort he makes with his work. Also, Doug is going to join. And Doug, you work with Jerome, that's right, isn't it? Doug's an associate professor at the University of Southern Denmark, has written 4 books, well, 3 on queering the canon, 1 on Foucault, you know, as you do. 4 books on queering the canon of Danish literature, including Hans Christian Andersen and Karen Blixen. So thank you for joining us today. Their paper is cleverly titled Genre Trouble, Trans Memoirs as Queer Archives. And I will leave it to you, with all the generosity of the room, to do as much as you can without any pressure.
There are a lot of reasons why it should be Jerome who should be talking and not me. So I am the substitute. Jerome was very generous to give me 5 minutes of his presentation. I'm going to take 20 if he's not coming. If he's coming, I'll give him the chair. I would just want to tell you a little bit about his latest book. It's just out, and I got it yesterday, and I've spent all night reading it, but I'm not finished. It's a wonderful book. It's called Wie ich von einer weißen Frau zu einem Mann mit Migrationshintergrund wurde. How I change from a white woman to a man with migration background would be the way to there's some German speaking here. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Translate it. And it's a novel, but it is as it's being launched as a non-fiction book because that's how it works in Germany. That wasn't what Jerome thought it was going to be in France because he wanted it as a fiction, but it doesn't work that way in Germany. It has to be Sachbuch. So that's also one of the interesting pressures of a book like that. It's partly about his journey. He can do it so much better than me. I feel uncomfortable even presenting it to you, but I just have to tell you, it's a wonderful book. It's partly what he discovered in his journey by, with a French background, as a, first of all, he became much younger, and people spoke to him in Arab in Berlin, because he's being read as a Moroccan young man, which he did not expect in his journey. So that part of it is a very interesting experience. So I am actually going to follow in the path of Marie-Louise. I'm so glad that Sandy Stone was mentioned as a queer scholar, not a trans scholar. I guess it doesn't take much for me to learn something about trans, but Sandy Stone was really a revelation for me, and she plays a very important part in my presentation on Lili Elbe, because as some of you, I guess a lot of you have read the Sandy Stone a post-transsexual manifestation. Do you know that what she actually, her main text, is exactly my text, Lili Elbe? Maybe you've forgotten. So her rereading of Lili Elbe has been instrumental in my understanding of Lili and in my understanding of trans theory, where I have to say I'm an amateur. So yes, I'm no authority on that. I want to tell you a little bit the story of Lili Elbe, who transitioned in 1930, probably as one of the very, very first in the world. It happened here in Germany, part of it in Berlin, in Berlin, part of it in Dresden. Lili was married to a very famous painter, Gerda Wegner. Do you know any of her paintings? I have one of them. Not one of Lili, unfortunately. I wish I had a Lili painting, but I have a painting of Gerda Wegner. This is a painting she did in 1920 of Lili. So you see Lili in this painting, painted when they were living in Paris. I think it's called, I've seen it titled as Siesta or something, but you know, you see, it's, I think at the time it was naughty to the point of being pornographic. That's how I would read it. You see the way she sits, legs apart, she's showing a lot of her underwear, she is smoking, she is drinking alcohol, and she's playing cards. Isn't sort of all of the sins almost there represented? So I think this is sort of supposed to be an eroticized painting of Lili. Actually, look at it very, very closely. Has anyone see that it's, in German you call it Fixierbild. Fixierbild in Danish. In English it's called picture paradigm. You know those kind of pictures where there are two motifs, but they are mutually exclusive. If you focus on one motive, you don't see the other. Okay. Can anyone see it? Well, I'll give you a hint. Look between her legs. No, you don't see it?
No.
Nobody? Really? Actually, it's the male genitals here. It's everything.
Oh, yeah.
You get it? Actually, that's actually sort of, well, that's all. I mean, all the details. So, no?
Has that ever been contested, or is that's been written widely in art history?
No, so far I'm the only one who's seen it. You can contest it, but it's hard not to see when you've. Do you agree? Well,
Look at it. You don't see it? No? Okay, well, we'll get back to it. Some of you might know the story of Lili Elbe, unfortunately, through the Tom Hooper Hollywood movie The Danish Girl from 2015. I'm not proud to say, but I was actually one of the consultants of the movie. I just want to make sure that you know that as a consultant you have no say at all. They take whatever you say and use it whatever they want, and they don't go back and ask you if it's supposed to be that way, because the movie is incredibly problematic. Does anybody know what Denmark looks like?
Yeah.
Do you know the beginning of the movie?
Yeah.
I was at the premiere and everybody started laughing. It starts with a very beautiful mountainous panorama of Einar Wegner's birthplace, which is Vejle Fjord. And we do have fjords, but we have no mountains in Denmark. So it's like you see Vejle Fjord and it's like this mountain panorama. It was filmed in the south of Norway, and to a Danish audience this is just like really weird, you know. It's like, what is going on here? And I'm sort of happy because it gives a warning to the Danish audience of people who know Denmark. Okay, if this is Vejle Fjord, how much can we trust the rest of the movie? Because it's really not based very much on Lili Elbe's own memoirs. It's actually based on an American novel, David Ebershoff's The Danish Girl from year 2000, where he takes all kinds of liberties and, you know, introduces new people. This Hans character is nowhere to be seen, and it's also, I think, incredibly, it's a good example of the cisgender view, because it's heterosexualized to the extreme, with the Gerda character sort of being this heterosexual woman, which she really was not, I can tell you that. And she's reduced to just a side character, and in my view, it would have been much more interesting to have made the movie itself on Gerda Wegner, because to me she's at least as interesting as Lili Elbe. So what I'm going to just introduce very briefly is the memoirs of Lili Elbe that appeared in Danish in 1931 and in German in 1932, and in English in 1933. Now, I was a naive queer scholar when I first read the 1931 version, and you can probably forgive me if you have a Danish book in Danish about a Danish person. Would you not think that the original was in Danish? I mean, I never even questioned that. It's not true. Lili told her story to a professional German writer who ghost wrote it, so to speak, and the German version, which is, I have it there, is actually the original version, okay? But then some of the letters, some of the diary entries or so have probably been in Danish, so it's not really, you can't just say that the German is the original version and the Danish is the translation, because some of the original material was in Danish, so it's like a philosophical and a philological nightmare, or a challenge, however you see it. So the way that Sandy Stone treats the text is to see it as the very first modern trans memoir, and she sees it sort of as the urtext, so to speak. She's very critical of it, or that whole paradigm that, in a way, Lili's text initiated, and I agree with the criticism. And it's just like Marie-Louise says, it has so many levels and layers, and it's so difficult to understand, well, where is Lili in all this, and who's speaking, and can the trans woman speak? It's co-authored with a professional ghostwriter. He makes it into a romance novel, which is very strange. And it's important for Lili, it's important. The text is, for her, it's sort of, I think a lot of it is interviews with her, but to her it's very important that this text proves that she is and always was a woman. So the title, German, the title in English, From Man to Woman, in German it's Ein Mensch wechselt sein Geschlecht, in Danish Fra Mand til Kvinde. She did not want that title at all. Her title would be Wie Lilly zu einem richtigen Mädchen wurde, How Lilly became a real girl. Hvordan Lilly blev en rigtig pige. So that's a very different title. But otherwise, she says, she likes the fact, she likes that style, obviously, which is very strange. It's like a Barbara Cartland in a trans memoir, because she falls in love with her doctor, with the doctor. And it's like a romance novel written about how she understands that the doctor is her master, and how she trembles before him, and how she, which is also very important, she doesn't ask any critical questions to what he does to her. If you see the movie The Danish Girl, where the doctor is the hero, and he's also the hero, of course, she calls it actually a hagiography, like she makes the doctor a saint. His name was Warnekreuz, but in the text she calls him Dr. Kreutz. Kreutz means crucifix, so he's Jesus and he's Savior and he's God. What he did in today's term, I'm not going to tell you the details, and I'm not belong to the medical profession, but it was like he was a quack. And what he did to Lily was, he had no idea what he was doing. It's like experimental would be a soft word to use, and he basically killed her. She died from these surgeries, not from the bladder infection or whatever. So I have a very different view on the doctor's role. Now, the interesting thing is that in the early 20th century trans memoirs, they all go back to Lili Elbe. It's not just Sandy Stone who does it in her theoretical and groundbreaking rereading of Lili Elbe's text. All the early trans memoirs, and they're almost all written by trans women the first and second half of the 20th century. Christine Jorgensen, some of you might know her, Jan Morris, Conundrum, and in all these memoirs, Lili Elbe's memoirs plays the same role. They all have almost parallel stories that they coincidentally stumble upon an old used bookstore, and there they happen to find a copy of Lili Elbe. So it's sort of like some kind of like hidden trans Bible treasure that they stumble upon, which I think is really interesting. So I would say that it is some kind of a trans Bible. I'll say a few things about Gerda Wegner, who's the very, very interesting wife, and she is the real, she is the money and maybe the brains behind the whole project. I feel sorry not to have it. Gerda Wegner was a very successful, was a very successful painter. She also illustrates some of the paradoxes in Lily's narrative, because when Lily has the biography is incredibly interesting, not so much because it all makes sense, but because it falls apart at so many junctions and points. It's full of paradoxes. Like Lily. Gerda at one point asked if Lily will continue painting, and Lily says, no, there's no way I can paint because women do not paint. This is very strange. Well, because, I mean, the whole thing is financed by the paintings of the wife, who was very, very successful. So it's full of these paradoxes. I can illustrate another paradox. What happens at the first surgery in Berlin. Lily goes to Magnus Hirschfeld's institute, and she hates everybody and everything there, and she does not relate to anybody. These are like abnormal people, they are perverse. She suspects that they are homosexual, which is something Lily clearly says she is not. After that, she has her first surgery. So what happens in the text is that already during the anesthesia, the voice changes, and Lily screams with the voice of a woman. Then she gets flowers. Yes. Then she gets flowers from one of her admirers. He's proposed to marry her, Claude Lejeune, and she scribbles a thank you note, and then gives it to Gerda Wegner, and Gerda looks at the note and says, "Oh my God, the handwriting has changed." And she shows it to the doctor and says, "This is not the writing, the handwriting of a man." And the doctor says, "No, of course not. Oh my God, it's the handwriting of a woman." So you see, you have these like almost magical aspects, and of course, you know, you have the proof of it. This is how Lily wrote before the surgery, and this is how she wrote after the surgery. And some of the most interesting things is almost the text of the illustration. There it says that it's a strong, typical male handwriting, and there, of course, it says it's a weak and vague female handwriting. So you see the difference there. So, no, you don't agree? Now you've had a little bit of time to look at it. You don't agree with it?
I don't, no. I must be completely honest with you. But I do thank you for stepping in. Thank you, Darth. I think what your presentation has spoken most loudly to me about your presentation is the spectacularization of trans lives, the hyper-fascination with wanting to deconstruct our bodies and our experiences, the idea of promoting trans firsts, and the way that we are thrown center stage right from the media through to academia. I would like to open up the question time now to all three of our speakers. Who would like to start us off? Thank you.
I can start, and thank you so much for the great presentation. I guess my question is Louise, and it's a two-part question. So it's first about how to, for many of us working with archives and museums, if you have any suggestions, ideas for how to get more trans narratives represented in the archives and the museums. But then the second part relates to the ethical question that Mary Louise pointed to, and also the chair pointed to. So when we get them, and when we make them visible and we disseminate them, they can be exposed to all kinds of readings, both reparative and paranoid and many, many other readings. Mm. And how do we kind of relate to the potential of violence lying there?
Yeah.
So do you have any reflections on that? Mm. They want the narratives, but then what?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Do you want to say?
I think I can answer this question from my research experience and in Thai context. From your question, right, to how to value like trans archive, right? I think from my experience doing from my research, I try very hard to like transform the position of Gatoi people in the history. Like, we have like described and record in many historical texts in mainstream historical texts, and yeah, it's there is a very negative attitude towards like trans people in Thailand, and I try so hard to turn the position from object to subject of the history. I think using like personal experience and explain how am I, how they are, how each community have their own history, have their own identity, will be more like value trans archive.
Yeah. I think I'm going to answer the question also more like in a methodological way, because my goal has actually also been to, most people, if they're writing about especially trans people, they would start from the 1960s, 1950s onwards. I mean, sometimes going back to Lillian Venus, which was the which is the official name of the person who's called Lillian, but the historical person was name was Lillian Venus. But I wanted to also look at like how could trans and intersex people transition in at a time when you didn't have the categories of transsexualism and intersexuality. And there I have actually also used a queer approach. So not looking at the categories, but you can say, I mean, one of the most fundamental widespread definitions in trans studies of what is a trans person would be somebody who is moving away from the gender position that is the assigned gender, and toward it can be towards any other position, you can say. And the intersex, I have also looked at and said, like, okay, so not saying their particular bodies or states of being or something that is intersex, but more saying that, I mean, at different historical moments, some people are perceived by others, also diagnosed, for example, but also might perceive themselves as a person who has some kind of combination or is in between or both a person who is male and female, man and woman, masculine and feminine. So you can talk about intersexing, I mean processes of intersexing people, and trans as this movement, the transition. Mm-hmm. So I was looking for transitions and I was looking for intersexings. Can both be people who did it themselves and other people. So that's also why I was looking for these applications of traces of transitions, you can say. So looking for the name changes, looking for these applications for wearing specific kinds of clothes, looking for applications that are connected to trans surgeries of different kinds of hormonal substitution and things like that. And I think that's a way that you can, without being anachronistic, ahistorical, but you can still talk about trans in any kind of historical period. But then also to be extremely specific about, but what were then the different diagnostic terms? How did people make sense of themselves and so on? And what I found out in my project was actually the at least from the end of the 19th century around the 1950s, also to some extent after that, people understood themselves and were also talked about as some kind of hermaphrodites. Mm-hmm. Hermaphroditism was a very wide category. It's not the same as intersex. It contained anything that you today would talk about as queer. That's not heterosexual cis. Mm-hmm. But people understood themselves as hermaphroditic men and women, and this was enabling the transitions, also in medical, but also both in medical and social contexts. So I think that's a method that you can use also for telling more stories, getting them out.
It's ironic though, isn't it, that the invasive, heteronormative, medicalization, the bureaucracy that surrounds it is actually what's left us with the archive to explore, to unpack all of those things.
Yes.
So it's like, joke's on you.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it's extremely difficult to find anything out of the medical legal context.
Mm.
That's also the thing. But I think
thinking outside of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's also why you have to be so careful about how you read it, and this not making any assessments of who means something, or like, is it a series, like what did they really, or there's no talking outside of this discourse.
Mm.
There's no way of understanding outside of that discourse. Mm. So, but it's both violent and enabling at the same time, I would say.
Mm.
In relation to just to answer that very quickly, the ethical question, I think this is a balance, it's a super delicate endeavor. It will always be dangerous. I don't think that there are all kinds of pitfalls, because No, I think that we have, because the stories about intersex and trans people have been singularized in medicine and in culture, we need to pluralize them. We need to tell all kinds of stories. We need to dig them out and so on and show how people have as many diverse lives as they have today. And they did. You can find that at the archive. And at the same time, there's this danger of like being transgressive in different ways or opening for voyeuristic gazes and these kinds of things. But I think we, to some extent, have to take that risk and then decide on how each of us do it and discuss that, why we are taking, why we are making the decisions we do, in order to open up for this multiplicity of life stories, also of the past. Mm.
Someone else? Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for your presentation. It was really very inspiring and interesting. I was wondering, like, I think it's really very important also to turn to cultural productions and subcultures. Like, for instance, if we see the paintings of Vera Wagner, if we replace it in the context of Paris in the interwar period, like, for me, so I'm from France, I'm working with such matter right now. I think immediately of Michel-Marie Poulain, who is a painter, French, trans woman from this period, and we have documents like also, for instance, a presentation she writes herself, a lot of paintings from this time for various exhibitions. Yes, there is also like problematic autobiographical materials, but I think it can be very interesting to reread also records, like autobiographical records, from the point of view of cultural perspective. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, I found in medical and criminal archives materials, autobiographical materials, but which point to life of artists, and you can reconstruct the path, the artistic path of people, and how the fact of transitioning affected their artistic path, like in terms of discrimination, of not having access to structures or institutions, or to financial means to pursue their activities, and so on and so on. And I think we should. I think it's time, like, really to try to move to this kind of approach, because we can really learn a lot. And for instance, like, also I'm thinking still about French interwar period, like about these paintings, like there's a whole set of practices, like you can think of balls in Paris at this time, like in Montmartre. You can find, for example, in literature a lot of instances of these, like I don't know, if you think of Carcot, if you think of Genet, if you think of all this literature, like it's very rich. And not only you have the literary text, like that are very often written by cisgender photos, but you have also like accounts that are behind the text. Like when you go to the archives of who writers wrote, actually, like for example Carcot, it's really like Francis Carcot, it's really very striking that you can find the text, like where Carcot refers to people he actually used, like figures, like models for his own writings. And you can find like trans women artists of this time, you can find like genderfluid people also that were part of Montmartre of this time. And I think it's very, very, very important that, you know, we like shift the conversation to it, because otherwise we will. I think it's like. It's also a question like of depathologization, and it's like really like I think it has to be central in our way to look at the archive. I'm sorry, it's not really a question.
No, where are you doing your research? Where are you doing your research?
I'm doing my research in Nanterre University in France. It's near Paris, and yes, I'm mostly working about music from this period. Yes.
Well, it wasn't a question, but I don't have an answer, but I have a comment. First of all, I mean, I would love if you could do something about Gerda Wegner in Paris. I don't care. It could be a movie, it could be an article, but we need that so badly. And I mean, in my mind, Gerda Wegner, I love Lily and I hate her, but I'm invested in Lily, but I think Gerda is more interesting even than Lily, and I think we need to know more about what happened in Paris in all those years. I can just have two more comments, just short ones. Like, one of the interesting paradoxes in the text also,
is that in Lili Elbe's version, retelling of why they moved from Copenhagen to Paris, was that Copenhagen was too immoral and there were too many divorces and they want to leave. So they go to Paris, which of course is the city of morality, right? I mean, it doesn't really make sense.
No.
You don't go to Paris to be moral, right? You know, and you don't escape provincial Copenhagen because it's too immoral, right? So that is really one of the strange paradoxes. So the fact of the matter was that Gerda was having lesbian affairs, and she wasn't always too wise who she chose to have affairs with, and she actually had an affair with the Copenhagen police director's daughter. So it was a very good idea to leave Denmark at that point.
We've got very limited time.
Just one more thing. Gerda and Lili, they wanted to be Parisians. They said, they were asked, well, are you Danish, are you French? And they said, no, we are Parisians.
May I hear? I know you had another comment, did you?
No, I just wanted to say that about Gerda Wegner, there is a book by Nicole Albert, which is called Sapisme et Décadence Paris 20th siècle, where there's an analysis of paintings of Gerda Wegner in the context of Parisian life of this time with a lot of historical elements. And so this work, I think it has been translated in English like right 2 or 3 months ago, but it's a book that is already like 10 or 20 years old. So, and there are also a lot in this book, you can find a lot of interesting elements about lives of trans people, actually, even if, like, because of the approach of the book, the focus of the book, which is on lesbian lives in Paris and lesbian subcultures, it's sometimes difficult to identify like elements, but it's a very interesting read. Like, if you want to have an overview of the period, it's with a lot of materials collected in the book, like paintings, programs of concert places, like you have it's a lot to find.
Thank you very much. We are running late because our session started late. If anyone has a pressing question, I'll take it from the audience, otherwise we'll call it a day. Quickly, yes.
Can
okay.
I just ask a quick question to you, Marie-Louise? You had a really concrete presentation about how to do ethical readings of narratives on inter- and trans lives. I don't mean to sound ignorant, but is there this method, can we find this in your dissertation?
Yeah,
that's what I wanted to point out.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extensive argument I make also. I mean, there are also many more examples than I gave here, but I wanted to point to some of the very, I mean, the concrete works that people have discussed.
And,
the
name of your book is in your biography,
yeah.
Is it?
Okay, yeah.
So that's one way of finding
yeah.
out.
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
we can all go there.
Yes. Yes, you can.
Another very
if you find it useful.
Mm-hmm. Me?
Yes.
I just wanted to hear maybe Marie-Louise and Esther would want to comment on this very interesting question about categorization and also using materials that are, you know, trans people and intersex people meeting the state, for instance, or meeting a school who is trying to make trans and intersex people live up to the rules and using that material without making it even more categorizing. Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. And I would like to hear your response to that. Yeah. If you want.
Can you repeat the question again?
Yeah.
Sorry.
I don't know if I can.
No,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but how? So I understood it as when you're working with material
mm-hmm.
that is pathologizing
yes.
the persons that's. I mean,
mm-hmm.
in your reports,
yeah,
it's the
yeah.
teachers and parents.
Yeah.
And in my, it's the medical legal. Experts, when you're working with that material, how do you write, how do you analyze yourself without repeating the pathologization? That
the I think. Can I answer you rather?
I would say, again, of course, it's always a delicate balance because. You have to present what people did, what they wrote. and how they assess people and so on. One of the things that I decided not to do at all, as I said, in this material, there are extensive descriptions. There were also loads of photographs of people's naked bodies, genitals, and so on and so forth. I have not, of course, I mean, mostly there are no photographs in my thesis at all. They're the ones that I showed you on the front page, where I think people are represented. It's like from people's everyday lives. It's everyday life pictures. It's also pictures that shows how people are in their social context, at the workplace, with families, with their friends, and so on. So I think that's one of the things, kind of not reproducing that kind of imagery, but also, I mean, I pay most attention to the autobiographies, but I also look at how, for example, yeah, also the medical certificates, how people's cases were assessed. I don't quote about like how people were measured and so on. I state they were. I don't like describe in detail how the genitals were described and things like that, but I do say what are the kind of conclusions, that there are some conclusions that this person is considered to be more female because, for example, the genital structure, but I don't describe it. So that's some of the, I think there are limits to, and I don't describe people's sexual practices. I mean, I can write they had a partner. Sometimes there are very detailed descriptions of that in the material. I have chosen not to go into that. I think you have to use, I mean, really be sensitive to what would be transgressive. What is transgressive to most people? I have talked with a lot of people about what they find transgressive themselves in the ways they have been evaluated. I've thought about what I would think myself and so on. So, but I think at the same time it's necessary also to be very precise about how the medical and legal experts have been transgressive towards people, how people are misgendered, how these things are happening, in order to show what is the kind of violence that people have been subjected to and are still subjected to. So, yeah, I think that's the way I have dealt with it. But again, it's difficult. Yeah.
Okay. I think in my study, I didn't want to repeat the pathologized term, but I want to deconstruct the term. As in Thailand, we perceive many pathologized terms from medical science, from religion context, and yeah, that should be like to deconstruct the term to show how it is constructed, like in Thai context. Yeah.
Mm. It's been a complex morning, but very interesting. I just wanted to thank all the speakers for your time and energy. Thank you, and your expertise and your research. Really valid. It's a blossoming field, but it needs trans people doing the trans research as well, I think. And to find yourselves empowered to do that and have institutions that support you, I think is incredibly commendable. I want to thank everyone else for taking the time to be here. I also wanted to let you know that I spoke to the museum in Brighton yesterday where the Museum of Transology is showing, and we've had a new run of the catalogues, the full colour catalogues, that have every single person's story transcribed in them, and done, if there's such a word as authentic, authentically, so no spelling mistake changes or etc. There's been a large production of them. If you would like a free copy of one, come and talk to me and I will give you my email address. Email me and I will do an international post out so that we can disseminate the project as much as possible. So just come and get my email. Okay, lovely. Have a nice lunch.